How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
It's one of the most famous crime cases in United States history. It took place either Christmas or the day after Christmas, 1996. JonBenet Patricia Ramsey was a six-year-old child here in the United States, in particular Boulder, Colorado. There was a long handwritten ransom note that was found in their home. Her father, John, found the girl's body in the basement of their house about 7 hours after she had been reported missing. And by now you know all the sordid details. She had sustained a fractured skull from a blow to the head and had also been strangled. A garrote was found tied around her neck. The autopsy report stated that JonBenet Ramsey's official cause of death was asphyxia by strangulation associated with cranial trauma. Her death was ruled a homicide, obviously. The JonBenet Ramsey case generated worldwide public and media interest, in part because her mother, Patricia Ramsey, a former beauty queen, had entered JonBenet into a series of child beauty pageants. The crime, still even of this day, is unsolved and remains an open investigation with the Boulder Police Department. You know all the details. You know what it's all about. But today we're going to take a look, not at the case in particular of JonBenet Ramsey. You've heard it a million times. There's been a million and one documentaries about it, movies, TV shows. For Pete's sake, crime channels have popped up in the wake of the very famous JonBenet Ramsey case. It has spawned... Really, I think it is, out of all the ones we've talked about, this is probably the one that is most responsible for the popularity of the true crime genre. Last week, we talked about John Walsh and the death and murder of his son, Adam Walsh, and what spawned America's Most Wanted and various other crime departments within the United States government that study crime. To tie this story to that one, I give you John Walsh talking about the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Now, I want to update you on one more recent case. Last Saturday, we took you inside the investigation of the murder of little JonBenet Ramsey. And since then, there have been new developments that could help us solve this bizarre case. Let's look at the latest. Boulder police brought a van full of evidence and spent 2 days at the FBI headquarters in Quantico, Virginia. They were there to review the material with criminal profile experts, hoping a fresh eye would provide new leads in the death of JonBenet Ramsey. Meanwhile, they released a copy of the infamous 2.5-page ransom note Mrs. Ramsey found the day after Christmas. Experts say the note shows a cover-up on different levels.
There is a disguise. There was an attempt to disguise the handwriting, but as the letter went on, the person was losing this disguise.
Notice the shakiness in the word "that" in the first paragraph. Then see the difference in the same word near the end of the note. Now look at how some of the words are spelled. Difficult words are spelled perfectly. Adequate, attaché, countermeasures. Yet the writer misspells simple words like business and possession.
That sort of behavior, to me, is indication of trying to dumb down the letter, to make the letter writer, this offender, look dumber than perhaps he actually is.
Look again. Do you recognize this handwriting? Notice how the T is tucked under the adjacent letter and how the capital D has an overhang. The letter's neat and orderly. Experts are hoping the release of the note could help crack the case. Joining us now is someone I've known and respected for years, former FBI profiler John Douglas, a real pioneer in the science. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jim.
Let's get right to the note. A lot of people believe it was written by Walt. What do you think?
We can't make that determination. Unfortunately, some of the top experts who I contacted said they cannot determine whether or not it was authored by either a male or a female.
Whoever wrote the note, what can you tell us about that person?
I believe the note was written beforehand. The person definitely has intelligence information about the Ramses. The person is above average in intelligence, planned the crime beforehand, has been in the house before, has intimate knowledge about the household, and so therefore we're not looking for a stranger.
Well, it's widely known that the Ramses hired you as an expert to help them find JonBenet's killer. You've been inside this investigation from the beginning. What's your thoughts? Have the Ramses something to do with it, or is it somebody else?
John, I was tough on the Ramses, particularly John Ramsey. At one point, I said, John, I said, if you did it, I said, you're one great liar, because I've interviewed some great liars in my life. And I don't believe they did it. The note, in fact, to me, reinforces that. There's too much minutiae in it, too many details that's unnecessary in a ransom note. So they did not do it.
That's a valuable opinion, because I know you've broken some tough cases. Now, if you want to take a closer look at the ransom note, you can find the entire document on the America's Most Wanted website at www.amw.com. John, thanks very much for being here. This is a horrible crime, and I hope that little JonBenet gets justice.
Thank you.
So this is Dragon King Dark. This is episode number 322, and you are entering in the midst of a long ongoing series, 100 of the darkest moments in pop culture history. In fact, we're well over the halfway point of this series, and you don't have to listen to them in any order. We haven't ranked these in any particular order. These are just 100 moments that had a tremendous impact on popular culture through some sort of tragic or dark event. And throughout this series, we've taken a look at a number of things. We've taken a look at the death of famous celebrities, musicians, movie stars, TV stars, sports stars. We've taken a look at scandals and just outright tragedies that occurred at things like concerts and auto races. And we're entering sort of a three-part sub-series right now, focusing on part of popular culture that is really popular right now, true crime. True crime has spawned thousands of podcasts, thousands of documentaries, numerous, even TV channels. I mean, the True Crime Network, Crime Investigation, Court TV, Oxygen True Crime, the ID Channel, Law and Crime Trial Network, True Crime Network. It goes on and on, Police Pursuit. There are a number of both cable and satellite and streaming channels that deal with nothing other than true crime. So how did this become so popular? How did this genre of investigative reporting, much of it amateur investigative reporting, become so super popular? Well, it was several very big in the media that crossed over into pop culture, murders and killings. And we talked last week about one of the ones that sort of got the ball rolling a little bit. Now, obviously, true crime and murder novels and crime drama novels have been around forever. I mean, you could even perhaps say that the Sherlock Holmes series in the late 1800s was tied into true crime, and very much a true crime was very popular during the Victorian era, especially novelizations and pulp. You could definitely pick up any number of tabloids, the old penny dreadfuls and things like that, that dealt with true crime even back then. So the public at large has always had a fascination with police work and with investigations and with a macabre interest in murder. And here in the digital era, it should be no surprise. Even throughout the era of TV, from the 1940s, 1950s, all the way up into the 1990s, think about how many crime drama TV shows there were. As reality TV becomes more and more popular, There becomes more and more documentaries, more and more series. And many of these, remember, as I talked about on last show, oftentimes don't necessarily always fall for these documentaries. These documentaries are often sensationalized. They're told from a perspective to get you interested. And most of the time that means, well, the official determination of this case has problems or is not true, or they got the wrong person, or they something like that. The killer's still out there. And then they spin some sort of conspiracy theory or some sort of alternative theory that leads you in a different direction and sensationalize it. As we hear the term in today's lexicon, it goes viral. People get outraged. They got the wrong person. This person's innocent. And hey, there's been instances where exactly that was true. But you have to remember, these documentaries, these podcasts, these TV series are telling a story for entertainment purposes using things that happen in real life. And to get you interested and to hook you, you have to have something that's different. You know, you have to call into question the official verdict. Now, there are many crime shows that, you know, tell you what happened and how they get to the verdict. And some are so sensational that they require no adjustments. But others take the tact of, hey, what if this person or this group of people did this? The case of the West Memphis Three comes to mind. And then there's a series of very popular documentaries and even books that try to cast doubt on that. And to be honest, there is some degree of doubt in that, and there is some sensationalism that even ties that into the Satanic Panic, something else we've talked about quite a bit here in the past on Dragon King Dark. But make no mistake, these are programs for your entertainment. But in this streaming age, the age of Rokus and Apple TVs and things of that nature, the computer, iPads, where you can stream straight to your phone 24 hours a day on demand, different shows like this, it's become a phenomenon. I mean, how many Netflix series have brought in millions and millions of dollars by telling you they got the wrong person, or let's re-examine this case? And as we talked about with John Walsh last episode, during the rise of the satellite TV era and the cable TV era, his show, America's Most Wanted, became very popular by getting you, the listener, you, the viewer, involved. You felt like you were now a participant. And many, many crooks were captured through that TV show by exactly that. And people want to get involved. People feel like they can see things from a different perspective. And sometimes that's true. I'm not at all criticizing the fact that many, many cases have been solved by amateur sleuths. And so here in the era of podcasting, this seems to have particularly crossed over well into podcasting, which is, of course, what we do, and is a very significant market into popular culture right now. Go on iTunes, go on Apple Podcasts, and just click over into the true crime section and look at the thousands of podcasts available and whodunits, and there's a reason for that. It's very, very popular. And some of these stories have captured the public imagination more than others. This week, we're going to talk a little bit about the JonBenet Ramsey case and how it's influenced popular culture and influenced this genre of pop culture. And then next week, we're going to look at probably the biggest case of them all that really got the public deeply involved. It was a sensationalized media trial. And of course, we could be talking about nothing other than the O.J. Simpson case, which definitely crossed over into popular culture. And it's something we would have covered in this series anyway because of the celebrity of the former football star, O.J. Simpson. And so we're saving that till next week to talk about. But without question, the popularity of true crime, TV channels, documentaries, podcasts, all that owes a large degree of its success to the ongoing unsolved investigation into JonBenet Ramsey. The Boulder Police Department initially suspected that the ransom note had been written by her mother, Patsy Ramsey, and that the note and appearance of JonBenet's body had been staged by her parents in order to cover up a murder. In 1998, the police and district attorney both said that JonBenet's brother, Burke, who was 9 years old at the time of her death, was not a suspect. Now, other conspiracy theories and documentaries and podcasts have claimed he was a suspect. In fact, he even had to file a lawsuit against, I believe, if I remember correctly, it was CBS in the multiples of millions of dollars for defaming his character, someone who has never been charged with this crime, nor were the parents ever charged, nor has anybody ever been charged in this. And again, the scope of this particular podcast is not to re-examine this story for the almost literally the millionth time, but instead to see how it has influenced a popular culture as a whole. Jean-Benet's parents gave several televised interviews, but resisted police questioning except on their own terms. In October of 2013, unsealed court documents revealed that a 1999 grand jury had recommended filing charges against the Ramseys for permitting the child to be in a threatening situation. John and Patsy were also accused of hindering the prosecution of an unidentified person who had, quote, committed the crime of murder in the first degree and child abuse resulting in death. However, the district attorney determined that there was insufficient evidence to pursue a successful indictment. In 2002, the district attorney's successor took over the investigation of the case from the police and primarily pursued the theory that an intruder had committed the killing. And we've all heard this theory. In fact, it's one of the leading theories into this murder. In 2003, trace DNA was taken from the victim's clothes. And this is going to become important. This is still part of the news right now in the second half of the show. I'll tell you why. So just keep the DNA evidence in mind. The DNA evidence was taken from the victim's clothes, was found to belong to an unknown male. Each of the family's DNA had been excluded from this match. The district attorney sent the Ramseys a letter of apology in 2008, declaring the family was, quote, completely cleared by the DNA results. Others, including former Boulder Police Chief Mark Beckner, disagreed with exonerating the Ramseys, characterizing the DNA as a small piece of investigation that was not proven to have any connection to the crime. And again, you have to understand, it's a very highly sensationalized crime. And just when you has, look, as someone who's been in law enforcement for 30 years now, just when you, because you hear DNA, does that is not the be-all and end-all of a thing. There could be trace contaminant DNA from any number of sources. The last time that dress was worn, someone in a different place could have sneezed. Or a hair got brushed off somebody and, you know, blew onto this piece of clothing or whatever. Or it could have been transferred from another piece of clothing from that. Just because there is the presence of DNA somewhere does not immediately mean, hey, this is the killer. This is someone who can produce crime. It is a clue. It is a something that needs to be checked out. But just because, you know, someone was, sneezed in a fast food restaurant that these same people happened to have went through, you know, a few weeks earlier, and that DNA was still in trace amounts on this clothing, does not mean that person murdered this child. So that is, yes, a piece of evidence, but it is not the be-all, end-all, conclusive thing that you're often led to believe by these documentaries and stuff. In fact, very oftentimes, DNA is gathered from crime scenes that, you know, there is no explicable reason how it got there. The people had literally never been in that location before, but somehow, some way, it was transferred to a piece of clothing, something as insignificant as a hair or saliva or something of that nature. And who knows how these things happen, but that's one of the things I think that true crime has really given people a false sense of, and among many things, is that, you know, DNA is the be-all, end-all of crime investigation, and it's not. It's just another piece of the puzzle. It's just another clue. It's just a clue in the overall picture. There are many things that true crime podcast documentaries and the whole genre severely misrepresent. Remember, these are programs. These are periodicals. These are, you know, shows done for entertainment. Their primary objective is not to solve a crime. Their primary objective is to sell that documentary or that podcast or get a listener or get likes or get shares or get you talking or get you coming back again. Hit that like, share, subscribe button. Leave us a review on iTunes, all that good stuff. That's the primary purpose, not to solve a crime. Now, is it sometimes helpful? Is it sometimes correct? Absolutely. Sometimes examining something from a completely different direction is very important and oftentimes help law enforcement see blind spots or fill in pieces of the puzzle that are not there, that they had no prior knowledge of. So those things can't be discounted, but at the same time, too, make no mistake that a lot of this stuff is severely misrepresented. My favorite, or I should say least favorite one, is this belief that fingerprinting is so germane and easy to do and that you can lift fingerprints from anything and put it in this magic machine and it spits you out a suspect. That is not even remotely work like that in the real world. Maybe in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles or some huge metropolitan police department that has its own in-house labs and things like that and trained specific techs to do that. But in 99% of America, that's just unrealistic, unreality. Fingerprints are notoriously difficult to lift in a verifiable way. And again, there has to be somebody that fingerprint matches to. Just because you've got a fingerprint doesn't mean it's going to match to anybody if they haven't been in the prison system or some other way have their fingerprints in the system. And getting it in the system is not nearly as easy as they make it out to be on TV. But you listen to true crime podcast, and one of the first things they usually chirp up about is, why didn't they pull fingerprints? Well, because it was probably a waste of time to do so. And certainly in many states are so understaffed on forensics that they're not going to run fingerprints for your everyday burglary anyway. Unless you send in a fingerprint for an actual homicide or something like that, they're going to go in the pile and never get checked. They just don't have the manpower to do that. In our state alone, there's probably almost certainly less than a dozen forensic scientists that work for thousands of cases. And they not only just sit around and doing DNA and fingerprints, but they also analyze breathalyzers. They also analyze the blood and urine specimens that come in for DUI arrests, accidents. They also analyze drugs. Yes, every drug case that's made that you send in, the same dozen people do all that. So they're not going to be analyzing your smudged fingerprint sample off of a burglary because they stole your grandma's watch or something. It's just unrealistic, but those expectations have been improperly raised the public's expectation that this is a real thing when it's not realistic at all. In fact, I went to a school, it's been about 20 years or so ago now, that Dr. Hank Lee that was very much tied to this investigation here, put on this class, and so much of what he taught in that class is different information than what the public seems to know all about this case. There were many things he said there. And again, you'll have to, I have to apologize. My memory's not spot on from one of 100 schools I took 20 years ago. But I do remember him making the actual statement of so much of what the public thinks they know about this case is either wrong or mistaken or, has been warped or just put out there for really sensationalized purposes. So we have to take all this. Well, then I know there is a definite feeling out there not to trust the government, not to certainly trust police or anything like that. And I'm not saying that's not founded in reality either. But unless you are a jury, unless you are sitting on that grand jury, and you have access to every bit of the evidence that's there in that case, you really have an incomplete picture. You really only have a presentation. And let's face it, the court's also, maybe they're not a podcast doing it for entertainment, but the court is biased. The prosecutor is biased toward getting a conviction, and the defense attorney is biased toward getting an acquittal. So they're both telling you a sensationalized version of the story for the purposes of obtaining a specific conclusion. Where does the truth even lie? Well, we hope that a jury can see the truth. We hope that a judge is interested in keeping testimony driven in direction of the truth. But make no mistake, many of you, I'm sure, have watched enough court TV to know, as is evidenced right now, if you're listening to this at the time it dropped with the Johnny Depp, Amber Heard defamation trial. You know, it's a lot of show. It's a lot of entertainment. And the truth may or may not have, you know, be what they're trying to do. They're trying to get a verdict for their side and sensationalizing it in both directions. And what the truth is lies somewhere in there for the jury to decide, and hopefully successfully so. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the basics of the crime. And again, we're not trying to re-examine the JonBenet Ramsey case, but what's the latest? Hey, there's something new on the case. As a matter of fact, even this month, there's something new. So we'll talk about all that and more right after this.
WhenItWasCool.com is your source for the best in retro pop culture. When It Was Cool features articles and podcasts on retro TV and movies, toys, action figures, pro wrestling, food, video games, and more. Hit the Patreon button to support us and get instant access to hundreds of premium podcasts and features. Family friendly and fun. WhenItWasCool.com.
In February of 2009, the Boulder Police Department took the case back from the district attorney and reopened the investigation. National and international media coverage of the case focused on JonBenet's brief beauty pageant career, as well as her parents' wealth and the unusual evidence found in the case. And that's another thing, too, you know, that was very sensationalized, her beauty pageant appearances. And, you know, I expressed myself some degree of discomfort with this whole thing, but apparently, you know, from what I'm told and understand, that these beauty pageants are largely benign and a pretty, you know, good way of building a child's self-esteem and things like that. And then competition's healthy. You know, young kids play sports and any number of things, and who am I to judge what these parents are doing? And it certainly spawned some other things. I mean, they're dance moms and Toddlers and Tiaras, I think, is a popular show that's out there. And so I think it shone a light on that aspect of popular culture as well, where these things have popped up and have people have found interesting. And I'll, you know, leave it up to each person whether that falls within their, you know, their boundaries or of morality or their moral compass, whether that's right, wrong, healthy or unhealthy or whatever, but it's nevertheless a true thing. It's a very much a thing that millions of people participate in. Media reports questioned how police handled the investigation. Yes, they became under a huge spotlight. The Ramsey family members and their friends have filed defamation suits against several media organizations. JonBenet Ramsey was born on August 6, 1990, in Atlanta, Georgia. She was the younger of two children of Patricia Patsy Ramsey, who died in 2006, and John Ramsey, born in 1943 and still alive and has done high-profile interviews even within the last couple of years. She had an older brother named Burke, who was born in 1987. He, too, has in recent years done high-profile interviews. JonBenet's first name combines her father's first and middle names, and her mother's first name was used as JonBenet's middle name. They ended up moving to Boulder, Colorado. In fact, she began school kindergarten in Boulder, Colorado. Her body was found December 26, 1996, in her family's Boulder residence. She is buried at St. James Episcopal Cemetery in Marietta, Georgia. So she actually is not buried in Boulder, Colorado, but in fact in Marietta, Georgia. JonBenet was interred next to her half-sister, Elizabeth Ramsey, who had died in a car crash nearly 5 years earlier at the age of 22. And that's often an overlooked part of the story as well, is that Patsy Ramsey did, in fact, have another daughter to die at a young age, and this one in a car crash. One of the more sensationalized pieces of this investigation, what I think rightfully so, is certainly one of the most baffling ones, was the ransom note that was found in this investigation. And there have been many podcasts and documentaries who have gone at long length about this, and I think rightfully so. This is one of the stranger bits of evidence in this case, and in all my years of law enforcement experience, I have worked numerous murder cases, nothing near the degree of media storm of this one. And who, I mean, these are very few. This may be the most famous child murder case in American history. I mean, I think goodness, you'd have to go back to Charles Lindbergh's child or something like that before you find one that was as pop culturally famous as this one. The ransom note, something else. I mean, according to statements that Patsy Ramsey gave to authorities on December 26, 1996, she realized that her daughter was missing after she found a 2.5-page handwritten ransom note on the kitchen staircase at the Ramsey family's Boulder residence. The note demanded $118,000, which is a strange, weird number to come up with. John pointed out to police first on the scene that the amount was nearly identical to his Christmas bonus of the prior year, which suggests that someone who would have access to that information would be involved in the crime. Investigators looked at several theories behind the dollar amount demanded, considering employees at Access Graphics who may have known of the amount of John's prior bonus. They also considered the possibility that the ransom demand was a reference to Psalm 118. And spoke to religious sources to determine possible relevance. The note was unusually long. The FBI told the police that it was very unusual for such a note to be written at the crime scene. The police believed that the note was staged because it did not have any fingerprints except for Patsy's and the authorities who handled it. And because it included an unusual use of exclamation marks and also different initials and commas and things like that that were unusual. The note and a practice draft were written with a pen and notepad from the Ramsey's home. According to a Colorado Bureau of Investigation report, there are indications that the author of the ransom note is Patricia Ramsey. However, the evidence fell short of a definitive conclusion. Michael Baden, a board-certified forensic pathologist, who had consulted with both sides of the case, said he had never seen a note like this in his 60-year experience and that he did not think it was written by an outside stranger. A federal court ruled it highly unlikely that Patricia wrote the note, citing 6 certified handwriting experts. The court bemoaned the existence of these self-proclaimed experts without credentials, trying to wrangle their way into the case by accusing Patsy without scientific basis. So what did the note actually say? Did you ever know what the note actually said? Well, here's what the note actually said. Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We do respect your business, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. Make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money and hence an earlier delivery pickup of your daughter. Any deviation of my instructions will result in immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you not to provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. Well, that gives you chills back to last episode, right, in the John and Adam Walsh case. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned, we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions, and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Victory, signed SBTC. And I'm sure many of you amateur sleuths noticed a number of things that jumped out. Number one, how do they know John was southern? That took some sort of pre-knowledge of his origins in Georgia to know this. And there's, you know, a number of things in here that are very, very strange. And this note, again, has been scrutinized and re-scrutinized many, many times. Again, beyond the scope of what we're going to do here. This show is not about the case, but about how it has influenced popular culture, especially the explosion in true crime-oriented programming. The case is still even in the news, even to this day. Matter of fact, the latest story comes from this month, May 3rd, 2022, and I take you to the CNN website, cnn.com. JonBenet Ramsey's father asked governor to have DNA testing in case done by outside agency. This is by Taylor Romine and Steve Almsey, byline from CNN. The father of JonBenet Ramsey, the six-year-old Colorado girl whose 1996 killing in the family home became a huge national story, is asking the Colorado governor to intervene and let an outside agency to take over the DNA testing in the ongoing investigation. On December 26, 1996, JonBenet was reported missing from the family's home in Boulder. Her mother, Patsy, told police she found a 3-page ransom note demanding $118,000 for the girl's return. Her body was found hours later by her father, John, in the basement room of the home. The case captivated the country since then due to JonBenet's involvement in beauty pageants for young girls, her family's wealth, and the initial suspicion around her parents, who were never charged and later cleared by authorities through DNA testing. The Office of Colorado Governor Jared Polis' office said Monday it is reviewing a petition asking him to intervene in the investigation. The petition claims Boulder police have not worked fast enough to test the DNA evidence and, quote, given the lack of progress, the petitioners are asking the governor to move DNA decisions in this case away from the Boulder Police Department to an independent agency so that JonBenet has a last chance at the justice she deserves. John Ramsey said he approved the text of the petition, signed it, and contributed to find its circulation. He told CNN on Tuesday the testing should be done by a third party. They are in a small community, and they don't have a lot of police resources and no experience in homicides, Ramsey said. I don't fault them for that, but they are refusing help from those who really knew what they were doing. Arrogance and egos got in the way, and there's a lot of qualified help willing to come in. Police have never explained to him or his family why they would not accept outside help on the case, he said. Patsy Ramsey died of cancer in 2006. John Ramsey has remarried and no longer lives in Colorado. Boulder Police Chief Maris Harold said Monday in a statement in the investigation, quote, has always been and will continue to be a priority for the Boulder Police Department. Police met with federal, state, and local agencies in March, the statement said, and multiple suspects have been run through the system to check for matches due to the huge advances in DNA technology. Ever since December 26, 1996, detectives have followed up on every lead that has come into the department to include more than 21,016 tips, letters, and emails, and traveling to 19 states to interview or speak with more than 1,000 individuals in connection to this crime, the statement read. In December, the department said in a statement around the 25th anniversary of the killing, investigators, quote, use new technology to enhance the investigation and check regularly for DNA matches in order to solve the case. Thanks to huge advances in DNA technology, multiple suspects have been run through the system to check for matches. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation has updated over 750 reference samples with the latest DNA technology. The Boulder Police Department works closely with CBI on future DNA advancements. John Ramsey has recently attended CrimeCon, a convention. There's another true crime something for you, CrimeCon, a convention dedicated to true crime, where he discovered some of the latest DNA technology is not always available to federal and local police departments, but can be contracted out to independent labs. He said some of the most compelling technology was the use of familial genealogy, a technique made famous through the identification of the Golden State Killer in 2018. Investigators identified him using a then-novel investigative technique known as genetic genealogy, which combines DNA analysis with genealogical research. DNA has changed dramatically. Technology has changed in 25 years, and there was DNA found on her body and on her clothing, John Ramsey said. There's also a good amount of evidence that was never tested in the first place. Ramsey said he was last briefed on the status of his daughter's murder case in 2020 after he'd requested a meeting with the new police chief. He has spoken to the FBI about the DNA technology in the last several months, but they were unable to share any information as they are not the lead investigators. He said the same detectives are still handling the case from when it happened, and it has been difficult to get new updates on the case. He's hopeful that new DNA testing will help solve who murdered John Monet, as it has in other dormant cases. There have been a dozen or so cases since that have used this approach using public databases of DNA, and it should be employed in this case, he said. Police have refused to do that, so we should take it out of the police hands. The latest appeal into his daughter's death has made Ramsey want to push for legislation to make the murder of a child a federal offense, so such cases are able to have resources outside the local jurisdictions where they happen. Let's bring the full resources of the government on that problem and not leave it up to the local police departments, Ramsey said. It's a mess. I've thought about it a lot, and the only way to fix it is to make it a federal crime. And we can't leave it up to local police, he added. And I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to have happen. Somebody who's worked in this field for three decades now, certainly the it would take a lot of stress and strain off of local police departments who often, quite frankly, aren't equipped to deal with super sophisticated. We just don't have the equipment to deal with the things on the same level the FBI does, so the same resources. And to get federal agencies involved would certainly take a big, would require a big investment by them. But it would probably be a good idea overall. I also think the Boulder Police Department probably should go with an outside agency. I mean, it's just going to make them look cooperative. It's going to, possibly lead to the solving of this case, which is best for everybody. Literally everybody wins if this case ends up getting solved. So, you know, but oftentimes, many times, police departments are portrayed as being, you know, greedy and not wanting to share information. This happens on lots of movies and TV shows. You've seen it many times. Some other agency will show up and the agency there gets mad and they start arguing over jurisdictions. That's largely fictional life, trust me. Anytime somebody wants to show up and give me a hand, I'm more than willing to take it, especially help me, you know, share the load. It's just taking work off me. That's largely a fictional thing, but still, there's nothing to be gained by not accepting as much help on this as is possible. So this is very much still in the news, still out there, still being talked about to this day. And so in conclusion on this episode, I'll leave you with a news story from when this did take place, so you can go back and revisit it again. And again, it's never my intention to try to examine this case again, because there, this thing has been examined so much from so many different levels, and there are literally hundreds and hundreds of podcasts and documentaries dealing with this that you're more than welcome to dive right into. But that's why it is on our list of 100 of the darkest moments in pop culture history, because this case itself has become popular culture. Probably not many Americans alive right now who can't tell you who JonBenet Ramsey was, and probably know when they hear the name what she looked like, see those beauty pageant pictures in their head, know that the parents were considered suspects at one point in time, and know a little bit about it. They may not know all the details, but I guarantee you, most people who are even remotely aware of popular culture know exactly who JonBenet Ramsey was. So, we conclude this episode with the news brief, and then next week we'll come back for, in my opinion, it's the one that really sparked the whole true crime sensation, because it was sensational. If you can say nothing else about it, it was quite a media circus. There's no other way to even describe it, the O.J. Simpson trial, and we'll talk about that and its influence on popular culture next week right here on Dragon King Dark. In the meantime, I hope you'll check us out over at whenitwascool.com, where we discuss pop culture and retro pop culture. We've got lots of shows dealing with a wide variety of pop culture topics. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about the comic book character Darkseid from DC Comics, and we do generally try to do comic book or music related stuff on Mondays. Tuesday, I have my pro wrestling history show, where we'll be talking about the history of pro wrestling in February of 1993. Later this week, we'll have the return of Uphill Both Ways, a pop culture, retro pop culture podcast. Wrestling with the Dog comes up on Fridays, and then mixed in there, we've got a couple of general discussion shows, the Heel Mustache Podcast, Fireside Chat, who knows what else. Probably have some other shows drop as well. In the meantime, check us out and join us back here next week for a new Dragon King Dark.
She's the adorable little girl whose murder has baffled investigators for the last 25 years. Six-year-old pageant contestant JonBenet Ramsey was found strangled in the basement of her own home in Boulder, Colorado, the day after Christmas, 1996. Inside Edition has been reporting on the case ever since.
A story that is gripping the nation. It is the investigation of the murder of little JonBenet Ramsey.
JonBenet's slaying is now one of America's greatest murder mysteries. 25 years later, after countless twists and turns, false leads, and dead ends, the case remains frustratingly unsolved.
Very little about this case makes sense.
Investigative reporter Paula Woodward has covered the case from day one. The investigation, she says, was flawed from the beginning.
You have a police department in Boulder which did not have a homicide department because they simply didn't have enough homicides to justify one.
So who did it? Early on, suspicion fell on JonBenet's family.
Please, if you know anything, I beg you to call us.
It was leaked by the police that the Ramseys, quote, weren't acting right.
But Woodward says the suspicions flew in the face of the evidence.
There are police reports which say that first night, Patsy and John Ramsey were hysterical with crying. They couldn't stand up. They would fall to the floor.
The Ramseys were officially exonerated in 2008. Posthumously, in Patty Ramsey's case, she died from ovarian cancer 2 years before. The case took a bombshell turn when this puzzling character came forward to claim he killed JonBenet accidentally.
I love JonBenet.
John Mark Carr flew back to the U.S. from Thailand to face questioning. But investigators concluded he was a fantasist who had nothing to do with JonBenet's slaying. Paula Woodward's new book, Unsolved, The JonBenet Ramsey Murder 25 Years Later, is just out.
She writes about the theory supported by most investigators, that a still unidentified intruder was responsible. Only advances in DNA technology may one day identify the killer.
I believe there's a good chance the killer can be found if they would test the remaining DNA for genetic components. I think that that's a real possibility.
If she were alive today, JonBenet would be 31 years old, but she remains a little girl, frozen in time, whose life was taken from her by a monster yet to be brought to justice.
In a statement issued today, the Boulder Police Department says it regularly compares DNA evidence using new technologies in hopes of one day making a match and finding JonBenet's killer.
WhenItWasCool.com is not only about remembering the retro pop culture we love.
WhenItWasCool.com is about remembering history and our place in it.
WhenItWasCool.com.
Sometimes When It Was Cool was then.
Sometimes When It Was Cool is now.
The When It Was Cool Podcast Network.
Nostalgia, history, pop culture, sports, TV, movies.
True crime, stories, society, culture, and our place in it.
Movies, retro sports, toys, history, music, wrestling, and more.
WhenItWasCool.com.
WhenItWasCool.com and the When It Was Cool Podcasting Network.